Morty Hutchinson on September 21st. This is the third tape, and we were talking about financing cars for purchase here in Union County. I had a question. How many dealerships actually finance the cars themselves, and how many went through banks, and how has that changed during the time you've been working in the field?
Very few dealerships, if any, were used the practice of financing cars themselves for the simple reason that it takes a lot of operating capital to run a car business because of the amount of inventory that you have on hand, both in parts, in equipment, and in new cars and used cars. And at the time that I was working for Gettings Lynch Motor Company, I remember we used to carry about $75,000 worth of used car inventory. And that meant you had $75,000 of your operating capital tied up on that used car lot. Well, the thing that you wanted to avoid was to get down so low in operating capital that you had to finance your used car inventory through the bank. Now, a lot of dealers weren't well enough off that they had to do that. They had to finance some of their used cars and all of their new cars. Well, what happens if you have an inventory of new cars sitting there and you have two or three slow months through the winter time, we'll say, you're paying the bank interest payments, flooring payments on those automobiles. And when you start out with about, back in those days, you'd only have $500, $600, $700 gross profit in those cars to start with. You don't have to pay the bank too many monthly installments on flooring charges, and pretty soon your profit has dwindled down to where you don't have anything. But you had asked me about financing. We did our best to finance. We would shop the financing with two or three, always more than one, financing institution, and we would advise our customer to take the least interest rate that we could get. And by shopping with two or three financing institutions, we were able to play one of them against the other and come up with as good a rate as possible for our customer. One thing that we didn't touch on, Ron, was when we were into the conversation about how the trade-in process worked. In some instances, in this scenario that you and I were talking about, where you're going to trade cars with me, you're going to buy a new car, your car is worth, your trade-in is worth $6,000, you owe $4,000 on it, so you have $2,000 net equity that we're going to apply to your new car.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to make any more payments on the old one. Well, say, look at this scenario. Say that you owed $7,000 on your car and it was worth $6,000. Now you have a minus equity. In other words, you owe more on the car than it's worth. So as a salesman, I have to say, Ron, we check with your financing institution. We'll say it's Wells Fargo Bank. And they say you owe $7,000 on your car. It would probably be $7,243.68. See, and we would have that figure exactly, and they would tell us this payoff figure is good for 10 days. So within 10 days, we would pay them off that much if we make a deal with you. But when I tell you that you owe more on your vehicle than it's worth, Now, in order for you to make a trade, you have to come up with some cash. Because, first of all, you have to pay off that vehicle. We have to pay it off. So we've got to get you to give us at least $7,000, whatever the trade-in or whatever the payoff is, so we can pay it off. But then you still have to come up with money to put down on the new one. You see what I mean? We referred to that as being upside down. The customer is upside down on his trade-in. He owes more on it than it's worth.
So, because you're dealing with two things. You're dealing with the price of the new vehicle and what you can allow on the trade.
That's true.
Do you balance those two figures so you come out with what you feel is an appropriate profit margin?
Well, that's always what we always try to do, but you'd be surprised. They're like the grocery business. They say they operate on 26% profit. And they say some of the cut rate grocery outfits, such as Walmart, will operate on 16% profit. We never ever, for instance, like the clothing stores operate on a certain percentage profit. They know what they have to have percentage wise in order to make a black figure at the end of the year. In the car business, I never did work for a car dealer that worked on a percentage basis. He works on strictly on the scenario of let's try to make a profit, but as far as a percentage profit, percentage never enters into it. Now, most dealers pay their sales people a certain percentage of what they take in on the deal. But you'd be surprised. Very, very many dealers operate on the same or less profit now with cars selling for 20, 30, 40, and 50,000 as they did back when they were selling for $2,000 to $6,000.
So a car salesman, if they're working on the same percentage, the boost that they would have would be it's a higher percentage of $20,000 as opposed to the same percentage as $10,000.
But they don't get paid on, see, like years ago I used to get paid on money difference between the trade-in and the new vehicle. They don't do that anymore. They pay you on a percentage of the gross profit.
Percentage of the gross profit.
Yeah. So you might sell a $40,000 vehicle, but if there's only, say, if they only made $800 profit, gross profit on the deal, that means gross profit is $800 before they paid the salesman, before they paid the detail shop, before they paid for any additional charges, which might be maybe they had a charge, maybe this car, in order to find the car that you were interested in, we had to send a man up to Spokane, pick up this car. He'd take one of our cars out of inventory, and we'd made a deal with the dealer up there to accept our car and give us the one you wanted. It was a different color and it had different equipment on it. We had to pay that man to take and drive up there, make that exchange and drive back. And so, you know, and we did that a lot, an awful lot. Because we, now that computers have entered into the picture, why you have right there in front of you, you run a search and you can find out where a certain vehicle is. You put in the equipment and the type of vehicle that you're looking for, and it'll come up with a list of dealers around the Northwest what the MSRP is on them, and the color and the equipment, all the equipment. You've already told the computer what equipment you have to have if you want an automatic transmission or a five-speed standard, what gear ratio you want in the rear end, if it's got leather in it or if it's got cloth, if it's got tilt cruise tape, air conditioning, and all these things. But when you get that car back, you have certain overhead that you have to pay off, and each car is charged, that overhead's charged against that new car number. So the salesman is paid on the gross profit after those things are paid.
Okay, now has the change in being able to find vehicles that you want and travel to get them, has that really increased that part of the business?
It's increased the fact, it's been good in this respect. You can offer your customer a great deal he has a great choice of equipment and colors, and he doesn't just have to look at your inventory and say, well, I kind of wanted a white one, but you got that light tan there, and my wife says maybe that'll be okay. Or he might say, you haven't got what I want in stock, and I'll just wait till you get it. Because a lot of people, you know, they want to look at it, feel it, touch it, look at it. Well, what you'd do is you'd sit down and you'd say, folks, if the car isn't exactly what you want, I don't expect you to take it. But I know that this car has been in this dealer's stock for 3 months. It has 120 miles on it, or it has 14 miles on it. It is absolutely in new condition. He guarantees me. If my representative that goes after these cars, he will inspect that vehicle when he gets up there, and if it isn't exactly what the dealer has represented it, he won't bring it home. And so I will guarantee you that if you like this color and you like this equipment that I've shown you, I've actually printed him out a picture of the manufacturer sticker. Here's what it's going to have on it. And you rest assured, that's what you've got me for. I will guarantee you that this car will meet with your approval when I get it here, or you don't have to buy it.
Okay. Who are the people who do the transporting? Do they work for the dealers?
Yeah. We have special people. They're trained. They're trained on how to drive new cars. They're bonded. They go up and look these cars over and inspect them. And even in the winter time, sometimes if a dealer said, well, you can have this car, but you haven't got anything in your inventory that I need. So we take a gooseneck lowboy trailer, and we may drive up there and load that new car and bring it back.
Okay. You mentioned once before, I think we were talking about people who did mechanical work on cars, that in some of the dealerships you work with, these people tended to stay for quite a long while in a position like that. And I think the relationship of them with car salesmen, I think you said, were not as likely to stay as long. What are the issues involved in that?
Well, dealerships right now, through the years that back in the, I'm going to say, 50s, 60s, 70s, the American manufacturing, automobile manufacturers, got to putting out shoddy workmanship. And the Japanese manufacturing, auto manufacturers, brought in cheaper cars, and they were economical cars, but they were well made for the most part. And because of the fact that competition forced the American car manufacturers, General Motors and Ford and Chrysler, into backing up and saying, hey, we've got to build a better product. These Japanese and German cars that are coming in are fantastic in workmanship. And so they took a look at things, and right now they're putting out a product that is as good as, if not superior in a lot of cases, to the Japanese and German manufacturers.
Now, the people who fix these vehicles need training. Did that change at the same time?
Yes, they by the manufacturers require that you, they aren't called mechanics anymore, they're called service technicians, and they have to be schooled in their particular category or their particular segment of the vehicle, of the technology. They go to school, they take they're sent down to special schools. There's a special General Motors training school in Tigard. With the fact that all of these mid-sized cars and a lot of even the smaller ones nowadays have a certain amount of electronic computers on board that control the timing and the air mixture and the fuel mixture and the different things, and these technicians have to go to school and learn how to deal with these problems and how to recognize this these different things that can crop up. They have what they call an electronic scanner that they plug in underneath the dash of your automobile, and they plug it into your automobile and they run a cord over to the master computer, and they sit right there, and that computer diagnoses the problem. If you have a problem with, say, if you have a vehicle that's not getting the proper amount of air into the air fuel mixture, it'll tell you. If it has a bad catalytic converter and it's not getting rid of the amount of exhaust that it should, it'll tell you that. There is a very, very simple thing right now that has come into the picture. If you have your car filled with fuel, and if the service station attendant does not twist that cap on tight enough, it will trip a code and a little light comes on your dash that says service engine soon. Which means that you're to take it to your selling dealer as soon as possible. You take it to the dealer and he plugs a scanner into it and types in some numbers, and it tells him that fuel cap was left loose, therefore emitting fuel vapor into the outside air, which is against the law, and that it thought there was no fuel cap on that vehicle.
So how much will it cost you to have someone tighten your fuel cap?
Well, what he has to do is, he says, hey, he goes back there and he says, the scanner and the computer tell me there's no fuel cap on this car. He goes back there and gives it a twist and it's loose. Well, it can cost you $50-$60 to get that done, because every year when the company representative, their computer representative, which comes from a computer company, comes in there and puts the new software for that year and all the updates in that software into your computer system and tests it and sets it all up and adjusts it, and will hand the dealer a bill for $5,000.
Okay.
So that has to be paid for, and people sometimes really get all out of shape because they think that they should be able to drive in there, and you put that machine on there and push those buttons and it tells you the fuel cap's loose. But that man had to stop doing what he was doing, and right now shop rate, the shop rate of a service technician is $65 an hour.
Okay. The people who start, I remember you worked on cars as a young man yourself before you entered the auto industry, working for dealerships. Is this computer technology changing how people get into this business, particularly mechanics?
You know, it's, I don't care what you do, Ron, if you have anything at all to do with so many businesses, especially the car business, first of all, you have to have knowledge of computers. Because when you sit down now and you figure payments for someone, or you figure you sit down to a computer and you don't even have price books anymore like we used to have. We used to have little price books and they'd come out and update them, you know, like every 2 or 3 weeks. They'd change some of the equipment or they'd get a price increase. They'd have to send us new books. Now you just sit down at the computer, and when you turn that computer on every morning, it automatically updates from the satellite, it updates your prices. And or they'll send you a disk by FedEx and you'll slip that disk in there and update your prices. But the computer world is controlling everything we do, and it, right now all this is so computerized that if these cars, people say, oh, they don't build them as good as they used to. But when you stop and think of back when we had carburetors and distributors and spark plugs that had to be changed every 10,000 miles, now they go 100,000 because they're platinum-tipped spark plugs. We don't have points and condensers anymore. It's electronic. We don't have carburetors anymore, so when you pull up to a, like you go out and get in your car and it starts and it runs perfect, whether it's 10 below or 125 in the shade, because the computer controls the mixture, the timing advance, and the airspeed setting and the fuel mixture. It sets all that as it runs. So in the morning, when your engine is cold and you start it, that computer is telling that airflow mixture to richen up that you need more fuel. As soon as the temperature comes up, it sends a signal to the computer. The computer readjusts that air mixture and the timing on the engine and everything. But it, as far as the driver is concerned, the consumer, it always runs the same. So as opposed to how it was back in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, when we started getting cars with air conditioning and power steering and a lot of things that the engine had to propel, the engine put out a lot of power to run power steering. It put out a lot of power to run the air conditioned compressor. You'd pull up to a stop sign on a hot day. You had 1 foot on the brake and 1 foot on the throttle, and you had to slip the car in neutral so you could keep it running. Otherwise, it would sit there and shake and vibrate, and you'd have a heck of a time keeping it going. And if it ran perfect here in La Grande, Oregon, you go down in the valley to Salem or Portland, and it didn't run worth a fiddle. So you always, now the day of computers has made these cars run perfectly all the time.
Okay, so a young man who wanted to work as a mechanic, auto mechanic, would have a very different route toward preparing himself for a job than he would in the past.
That's true. If he walked into a dealership and said, I want to go to work as an auto mechanic, and they'd say, well, how much training have you had? Have you been to trade school? Well, if that fellow has been down to Oregon Technical Institute, and he studied computers, and he studied how to make these, how to read these computers and adapt them and make them follow what they tell him is wrong with this engine, plus the fact that he has to know how to take them apart and put them together. If he's had that kind of training, chances are he'd get a job. If he hasn't, then they can start him on the lubrication rack, and maybe he would advance to doing small jobs such as brake work and wheel bearing packing and things like that. But he would never get into an advanced electrical technician, which is one of your key personnel, or automatic transmission specialist, or a heavy duty mechanic. See, there's several different segments. You've got an electronic specialist who never touches automatic transmissions or heavy engine repair. In other words, he doesn't tear engines down and work on them like they used to. He'll only deal with electronic problems and tune up electronic problems and air conditioning. Then you'll have a heavy duty mechanic that deals with rear ends, gear replacement, engine replacement, transmission replacement. Generally, a transmission specialist is a transmission specialist, and he works on transmissions and gearboxes. And as opposed, one point I wanted to make, and I'm getting clear off of car selling, but in the automobile business anymore, because of the high rate of hourly wage involved, anything that takes a lot of labor, they have to weigh the cost of the labor of tearing into something and rebuilding it against if they order a new, what we call a crate rebuild engine, or a crate brand new engine. The engine comes in a crate, you uncrate it, you take the some of the accessories such as air conditioning and the alternator and the things like that off of the old engine, put on the new one, take a chain hoist and drop the new engine in there. You can't afford to pay a mechanic $60-some an hour to go in and take the pistons out and take the pan off and take the intake manifolds off and exhaust manifolds and go through this engine. You can't, it's not in, it's it can't, theoretically, you'd have more money in it, you'd have almost twice as much money in it as if you bought a crate engine or a crate rebuilt or new automatic transmission.
Okay, when did this start to change? Because I think you're also talking about the change from a general mechanic, local mechanic that would fix almost anything on your vehicle, to specialties.
Yeah, if you look, if you just drive down the street and you look at how many used to have 2 and 3 and 4 service stations on most corners in your outlying edges of town, like your east and west end of town, you'd have service stations. And many of them had a sign out front, mechanic on duty. Now, a mechanic, he's not sharp enough and doesn't have the tools to work on the larger percentage of the cars that are running up and down the street. You've got to take that car, you almost have to take the car back to the dealership that represents that car in order for them to diagnose the problem, order the parts if need be, and have a man there that's savvy enough, educated enough in that specific car model to know what's wrong with it.
How many, I know there are still some repair places in LeGrand. Is that number decreased? over the time where there's a small repair shop that will pretty much do general work on vehicles?
Yeah, there's just a very few of them. One in which I know of in particular used to be a technician for MJ Goss Motor Company. He was trained by General Motors dealers. So he buys the same equipment that Goss Motor has, and he sets up a shop and hires mechanics, and he teaches these mechanics to do work. There's still a few rigs out there. There's a few pickups and older cars out there that don't have computerized stuff, that still use carburetors and aren't fuel injected. And they operate these little shops and do these little jobs, such as, you know, there's always wheel bearings or gearboxes that need opening up and worked on and everything. They don't get as much money an hour as your main shops because they don't have to maintain the high technology, the technological equipment that it takes to keep these new cars going. So they can, excuse me, they can operate on $55 an hour instead of $65.
Okay. Now, a person working as a mechanic of whatever different type make a good living wage?
The technician you're talking
yes.
about? Oh, yes. Yeah.
They
Depending
do.
On their experience and the amount of training they've had. And by that, I mean, you go to these shops, to these, like, you go into Goss Motor, for instance, and on the wall displayed will be a technician's name. And there will be his certificates of accomplishment where he has been certified by General Motors that he does have special training in by Chevrolet and Oldsmobile and Pontiac, Buick, Cadillac, or whatever. And he'll have those credits posted on the wall in the general service area where you come in and talk to your service writers and your service manager about what you want done. And just, you know, they're all key men in their own field. Even a lubrication technician is not a grease monkey anymore. He knows what that car, what points that car has to have checked on it. And while he doesn't actually have as many, if any, grease zerks that he has to shoot with a grease gun, but he has duties he has to perform. He knows the type of different specialized lubricants that have to go into those vehicles, and he checks that stuff from one end to the other because these cars are, they can't be serviced in the same way they were 40 years ago.
Now, he would also have to keep up with his education and training on that as the vehicles change.
Yeah, and there isn't as much now required of a service technician as there is electronic specialist. Or a transmission specialist, or a heavy-duty mechanic, line mechanic, but a technician. But they have to be trained. These are key men in your establishment, and believe me, when you go in and you've got a problem. And they say, well, what's your problem with your car? And, like I had a little service problem, just a little irritating thing on my new Trailblazer, Chevrolet Trailblazer. I went in last week, and they set me up an appointment with, I had to wait 3 days to get in to one particular service technician because he was the one that was going to deal with this problem. And the problem was a little noise underneath this center steering airbag behind the steering wheel. Well, he has to get in and disarm that airbag so it doesn't blow up in his face. And he has to take and disassemble that horn system there and that airbag underneath it and get down to where this wire and this contact was making this funny clicking noise when I turned the steering wheel. And he's got to have the technology and the know-how to do that, or, you know, you blow one of those airbags up, it's about $700. So do you see why he's got to be trained? He has to be trained.
Okay. Now, the salesman, do they have as much job security, and what does that depend on? And do they stay with dealerships?
Salesmen are as far as job security, they have job security. All they have to do to maintain job security is produce. And they have to have a clientele and a good rapport with customers. And when customers come in and say, is so-and-so here, I've been looking around for him, can't find him. If the phone rings and the girls are calling for your name, line one, line two, you know, all day long, and you get phone calls, you know, a dealer doesn't have to be a rocket scientist to see that you're active, you've got people wanting to talk to you, you're out there talking to people about automobiles, then you've got job security. But if you sit, you know, someplace and watch TV or read magazines or something like that, or spend your time out on the golf course, then you're not going to be very productive. You're not doing yourself any good or them either. We were always taught that in sales, you have one item that is the most important thing in the world to you next time. If you mess around and you goof off and you lose 8 hours, you've lost it. You can't ever get it back. And that's 8 hours you could have been productive. You could have gone out and contacted four or five people and talked to them, you know, and I used to prospect by walking up one side of the street and cross over and walk down the other side of the street some days. And you would do nothing more than just visit with people. And I'd always, if I walked five blocks up Main Street, crossed over and five blocks down the other side, I'd always pick up two, three prospects. Somebody said, hey, Shorty, watch for, I'd like to get a good pickup, how much money you want to spend, so many $1,000, you know, and something with not too many miles on it, and something decent that I could use for a second or a third vehicle, or we're looking for a car for our son who's going to be going away to college here, you know, right away, and blah, 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 but this is all the way you prospect. And now, I'm sorry to say that an awful lot of salesmen, you can ask them, and the biggest part of them, they don't know where their customers live or where people live, or they don't know about how many kids they got in school, or they don't know anything about their business or anything. And I can remember, not that I was a perfect salesman, but I found that I knew most all of my clients through the years. I knew where they lived. I knew their wives. I knew their husbands. I knew how many kids they had in school. And I would go out and talk to them out in their barnyards, or I'd go out to the sale yard on Thursday and sit up there while they were buying cattle or selling cattle or hogs, or while they were loading them out in the chutes. And maybe I'd talk to somebody, and I've closed a lot of deals by verbally, because they'd say, I'll be in when I get this grain cut, Shorty, I'll be in, and we'll talk about that new Scout or that new Jeep or that new pickup. But I made the contact out in the field. And one of the best places I ever found to prospect this time of year was out in the line waiting to dump the grain at the grain elevator. And there'd be 10, 12 trucks waiting in a line right there. Well, when I was a kid, I used to drive grain truck in the summer times for farmers. And I knew that you wasted a lot of time sitting in that line, and you'd move up and you'd sit there for 20 minutes and you'd move up and you'd sit there for 20 minutes. Well, awful good place to prospect is go out and park your rig and get out and talk to those people.
Did other salesmen back when you were doing this, did other salesmen do the same kind of prospecting?
Some of them.
But it was a good way to be successful.
It was the only way.
It was the only way.
It was the only way. And before us, before we, my segment of the salespeople that I sold with and against, and people I sold for, back in the old days, they used to get in a car because they didn't have a lot of new cars in their inventory. They'd get in a car and put a dealer plate on it, and they'd go out and drive it around to these people's houses until they sold it. Then they'd come back and get another one. They'd drive out through there until they sold it. And I've worked with old time salespeople that used to sell. I worked with a salesman for several years, and I used to get a just really liked his stories about the old days. He had a demonstrator with the first windshield wiper on it. And he also used to go up into a little old logging community up at Maxville on payday, because they'd have poker games, and these guys that worked up there would get in these poker games, and whoever was the big winner would usually buy a car. And I know a fella that bought a car one time up there, ordered a new car from him, and he was a young kid, and they had to put wooden blocks on the pedals so he could reach it. But it was also before he had to have a license to drive.
When did that happen, people had to have a license to drive?
This older salesman that I worked with had, back in the old days, had sold Studebakers. And he sold Studebakers back when they had a Studebaker that a certain model that was supposed to have the strongest roof in the business. And in order to prove a point, they built a square porch over up on the roof of this Studebaker demonstrator, and they put a piano and a six-piece band up there and put it in the rodeos, and it went out and drove around the rodeo grounds with three gals up there singing and a guy playing a piano. This little, and that's the way they demonstrated. But he used to go up and work in this little logging community of Maxville up out of Wallowa. And when you go up in the Wallowa, you see the sign now, it says Maxville, and it goes off to the left there as you first come into Wallowa. And that was a thriving little community. Had a lot of fellas up there working in logging, and he often went up there and sold automobiles. And he was at one time a county clerk for Harney County down in Burns. And he showed me the first year that you had to have a driver's license, and it was he carried it in his billfold. And if you ever got stopped by the city or state police and they ask him for his driver's license, he'd oftentimes give them this old driver's license just to get some kind of a raise out of them. They'd say, well, sir, you've certainly got a newer license than this. But I think that was around 1919 or 1920 that you had to have a driver's license in the state of Oregon.
Hmm. Okay, I noticed recently along the Island City Strip, there are these car lots that don't seem to have much overhead. They're basically just vehicles put out there. How recent is that type of business, and how do they do it?
Well, the mayor of Island City would require anybody within his township to have a dealer's license. And in order to have a dealer's license, anybody that sells, I forget, it's over three vehicles a year has to have a dealer license. And there used to be some shady characters around it, and they would sell, they'd go and they'd buy a car from somebody, or they'd buy one from a dealership, and they'd go out and put on a lot, put it out in front of their house, hang a sign on it for sale, sell it at a profit. Maybe they'd make $100, maybe they'd make $150, maybe they'd make $300, who knows. But they try to police that because they require them to have a dealer license. In order to have a dealer license, you have to be bonded, because you have to be bonded and a bond will cost you anywhere from $600 to $1,500. I don't know. Last dealer license I held was in 19, when I was in a recreation vehicle, travel trailers and used cars, and my bond at that time was for our dealer license was I think around $800 a year.
Okay. Now, are these all sold as a dealer's cars, or are some of them just sold by the actual owner of the car?
They can be sold as an individual car. Like, you can sell your car and buy another one. Maybe you drive it 2 months, you don't like it, you can sell it and buy another one. And they won't bother you as long as you don't misrepresent and get into trouble. But if you get into trouble with somebody that bought one of your cars and they come back and say, hey, this car isn't what you represented, by law, you're supposed to have a sticker posted on the window of that car before you ever offer it for sale. And that window sticker, if you'll go down here on any car lot and look at that sticker that's posted, it states that this car is sold with warranty or this car is sold without warranty. And even if it's, say it's only a 1 or 2 year old car and still is covered under the manufacturer's, under the remaining portion of the manufacturer's warranty, then it states there that this car is not sold with warranty. And then down in the fine print here, it says the reason this car is being sold without a warranty is because it's still covered by the remaining portion of the manufacturer's warranty. 3 years or 36,000 miles, whichever comes first.
Okay. Now, I've noticed some vehicles that I had seen previously on Route 82 between, say, near Allisell, had appeared on one of the lots out here on the strip. How is that business working? Are people looking for used cars that they can rent space?
I think you're probably referring to out on Highway 82, every now and then you'll run across a car that's sitting there with a for sale sign in
mm-hmm.
it. Most all of them are tan in color,
mm-hmm.
and they're owned by the estate of a fellow by the name of J. Dale Stanley. He painted everything that he owned the same color. That was his favorite color. Believe it or not, one time I sold him a brand new 1966 or 67 Jeep flatbed pickup, and he took it home that night and repainted it tan.
And how did these vehicles end up out on one of the strips?
I think his wife is having different people that they knew. He was a very prominent farmer at one time. He passed away several years ago. I think she has gotten permission, maybe a son or daughter of his has gotten permission to place them out there with a for sale sign in them. Out in Island City, the particular lot that I've seen them on is a lot that I understand that if you want to sell a used car, you can come and place the car on that lot and put a for sale sign in it and the particulars, how much you want for it or whatever. And I don't know if you pay them a little commission when you sell the car, how it works. That's the only kind of a lot I've ever seen that done on, that particular process. I don't know if it works or not.
And this is fairly new development here.
Brand new within the last year.
You used to see cars, two or three vehicles at gas stations.
Yeah.
Sometimes for sale. Back in the days when mechanics at those stations worked on vehicles, was that the same kind of selling, reselling for a little bit of profit?
Well, it depended. Sometimes if a service station owner had a customer, a good customer, and he said, hey, Al, I want to sell this pickup. Can I set it on your lot with a for sale sign in it? And if the service station owner, proprietor, felt obligated, he might allow him to do that. But he might also get a visit from a state policeman who came in there and wanted to see his dealer's license. And if he couldn't produce a dealer's license, then he better have a good reason for having that vehicle sitting there with a for sale sign in it. And he might tell the state policeman, and I've seen this happen. He might tell the state policeman, this is a customer of mine. He's got sickness in the family, or it belonged to this guy's wife, and he wants to sell it. She passed away, or whatever. But he better have a story, because sometimes a dealer will call the state police and say, hey, I got a service station up here on such and such Adams, and he's got two or three cars up there for sale. How come he can do that without a license, and you make me buy a license and bonded and all this stuff that it costs me? I've got a lot of overhead here to protect, and yet a guy can put two or three cars up there and he doesn't have to have a dealer license or be bonded or anything. What goes? So the lieutenant out there, or whoever the head guy is out there, in cases that I know of in the past, he'll say, I'll have my patrolman check that out right away and get back to you. Because
if the gas station owner didn't make any money on it, can he still do that?
Well, I don't know. There you're talking about a legality that I don't know just where the point of law is there, Ron, but I do know they weren't allowed to do it. You could do it once or twice and do it and get away with it. But if you make a practice of displaying cars with for sale signs on them, those cars had better have the appropriate stickers attached to the window, and you better not make a practice of doing it unless you've got a dealer's license, because you don't have to be a Philadelphia lawyer to know that something is not right.
Okay. What kinds of cars, since you started working selling cars particularly, What kind of cars sell in Union County, and how has that changed over time?
Well, we, of course, the larger number of sales used to be in Chevrolet, Ford, were your big sellers, your big numbers. Then you had, because we, I say Chevrolet and Ford because we didn't have a substantial Chrysler Plymouth dealer in the area. We didn't have Japanese car representatives in the area. So your big numbers were Chevrolet and Ford because they were cheaper than Pontiac, Buick, Cadillac, and Oldsmobile. So you sold lot more Chevrolets and Fords. Then when Japanese cars come into the picture and they were cheaper and the quality was pretty good on them, very good in fact, people had to go out of town and buy these cars, but they also had to go out of town to get them serviced. Now, you stop and think of this scenario, and I've seen it happen many times. If I sold a new car to somebody and they took it home and they drove it for a couple, 3 months, and one morning they wake up and it won't start. They pick up the phone and call me and say, "Shorty, my car won't start this morning." I say, "Okay," and they say, my wife had to catch a ride to work with one of her working acquaintances," and I'd say, "We'll get right out there and find out what's going on and leave the keys in the car. You're going to be there." And anyway, I'd get a service. I'd go to the service manager. He would get a service truck. We'd go out. Maybe it just needed a jump start. Maybe the battery was faulty and went bad. But in a lot of cases, I was out there within 30 minutes. If they needed a car, if she had to have a car or he had to have a car, we'd take the car to them, say, "Don't here, use this car. It's a loaner. Don't worry about it. I'll find out what's wrong with this, and I'll get back to you." And if it was just a thing like changing the battery, which it often was in a case like that, we'd put a new battery in it, take the car back to him, exchange with him, and everything's okay. Now, compare that to this picture. You bought this car from a Toyota dealer in Milton Freewater, or not Milton Freewater, in Walla Walla or Hermiston, and you wake up some morning and it won't start. And you call the dealer and say, "My car won't start this morning." And he says, "Gee whiz. Well, could you get somebody to come out and look at it and try to see what it is? Is it the battery? I don't know what it is. It won't start." "Well, yeah, you suppose you could have it checked, and if it's a battery, get somebody to jump you so you can get it over here to us." Now you got two scenarios there. Which one would you rather be the victim of? See what I mean? So it's that's why people did eventually start drifting out away from their hometown and buying Japanese cars because they were cheaper.
Has the service changed? Because there's an All Foreign Autos place now in La Grande that do work on foreign.
Yeah, they work on foreign cars because, as a general rule, dealers have a commitment to their clientele and to their customers. And if they tell you, "I'm not going to be able to work on your new Chevrolet or your new Pontiac until about a week from Thursday," and you look over there and you see a Mercedes and a Toyota and a Honda, you're going to be a little bent out of shape. why did I buy this car from you, and you say you're going to service it for me, and you're taking care of foreign cars here, why can't you put my car in there? So they don't work on anything they don't sell unless they have nothing else to do. And somebody, say if a fellow's a good customer, a good Chevrolet customer, or a good Ford customer, and he also has a daughter that has a Toyota, naturally the garage is going to make an exception and work on for him occasionally if it needs some little thing done. But they're not going to have the special tools to do very, very intricate or sophisticated work, and neither is all foreign auto.
Okay. What did you learn during the period of time when you had your own RV business?
In regards to what?
Well, selling, the market, how was it trying to run a business like that? What motivated you to start that?
Well, the RV business was people were buying something to enjoy. Interest, the rate of interest on people's investments was very good then. You know, it was up, you know, in the 10-12% bracket or more, and they were buying travel trailers to take and enjoy and have fun with, go out camping, take long extended trips, go south for the winter, things like that. And you any kind of a used travel trailer or camper that you took in within reason, if it was a good piece of merchandise, you could resell, and it was a fun business. And I did it for about 10 years. I had a partner, and we did it for about 10 years. And he had been in it previously, and we had sold cars together back in the 50s. And so it was just got into it sort of by accident, but to get a little relief and try something a little different.
Was it similar to an automobile? You wouldn't have to deal with repairs, but you would have to deal with a lot of different kinds of parts.
Yeah, we sold a lot of parts, fast moving parts, service items that people needed for their sanitation and LP gas and things like that. We sold a lot of small parts. We sold a lot of trailer awnings. We sold a lot of new Fleetwood Terry trailers because the factory was right out here and we were the franchise dealer. And we also sold some new, we dealt in used cars. We'd go buy, if we had an old customer, both my partner and I had been in the car business. We had somebody come along, wanted us to watch out for a good used pickup or an automobile for him. Why, we'd try to find something and fit it into that picture.
So as your car work, a lot of word of mouth, knowing customers,